Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I spoke with Dr. Emily Wilcox about her new book, Revolutionary Bodies, Chinese Dance and the Socialist Legacy, recently published with the University of California Press. Emily is Assistant Professor of Modern Chinese Studies in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Michigan, or as Buckeyes like myself must call it, that school up north. Revolutionary Bodies is the first English-language primary source-based history of dance in the People's Republic of China. Combining a decade of ethnographic and archival research, Dr. Wilcox analyzes major dance works by Chinese choreographers staged over an 80-year period from 1935 to 2015. Using previously unexamined film footage, photographic documentation, performance programs, and other historical and contemporary sources, Wilcox challenges the commonly accepted view that Soviet-inspired revolutionary ballets are the primary legacy of the socialist era in China's dance field. Our conversation ranged from the practicalities of publishing a new style of book in an open access format and using a large number of video resources in a book, to the term kinesthetic nationalism and the transnational nature of early Chinese dance, to the socialist legacy of post-Mao dance. It was a fascinating conversation, and I hope you'll find it as enjoyable and informative as I did. Stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm joined by Professor Emily Wilcox. Emily is Assistant Professor of Modern Chinese Studies in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures at School Up North, as I, a Buckeye, am obliged to call it, also known as the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She is a specialist in Chinese dance and performance culture with broader interests in 20th century global history, transnationalism, gender, and social movements. And today, she's going to be talking about her first book, Revolutionary Bodies, Chinese Dance and the Socialist Legacy, recently published with University of California Press. Emily, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Emily, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Michigan. I started dancing from a young age. I first did ballet, and then when I was in college, I did competitive ballroom dance. And I also studied anthropology as an undergrad at Harvard, and then in my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. And then after completing my PhD, I went on to teach at the College of William and Mary for 2 years. And then I've been teaching at the University of Michigan now for 6 years.
Fantastic. And how did you come to write this book, this Revolutionary Bodies book?
Well, when I was doing my PhD, like most graduate students, I, you know, was exploring and trying to find an exciting topic that could produce innovative research. And at one point I was taking a graduate seminar on the history of international comparative history. At the time it was between China, Qing China, and Republican era China, and the British Empire, and thinking about cultural exchange. And I ended up writing a research paper on Shanghai. and its history in the context of the circulation of ballet and Western modern dance, and then also the early history of Chinese classical dance and Chinese dance drama. And it was while writing that seminar paper that I started to realize there was this whole field of dance history that could actually be a window into thinking about a lot of bigger issues about China and its place in the world.
Very cool. And that sort of, that became the dissertation, that became the book in its present form, or?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. So actually, like I said, I did my PhD in anthropology. And so initially the project was very ethnographic. So actually during my fourth year of graduate school, I ended up getting a Fulbright to study in China. And I studied for almost 2 years at the Beijing Dance Academy, which is the oldest and the most prestigious professional dance conservatory in China. And while I was there, I primarily studied Chinese dance, both Chinese classical dance and Chinese national folk dance. And then I also did ethnographic field work in Beijing and then in a number of other locations around the country through short-term visits that were connected through this larger professional dance community. And so the original dissertation was actually very much focused on the contemporary period, and it was very much focused on my own ethnographic experience as a dancer in the conservatory setting. So a lot of emphasis on my own kinesthetic experience and knowledge as a dance practitioner, and then a huge amount of material based on oral histories. So I collected about, at that time, 150 oral histories of professional dancers of different ages from different places across the country. And I really used that material as a way to think about the expression of national identity, ethnic identity, class constructions during the socialist period, and then also the particular aesthetics and philosophy of bodily movement as part of China's socialist and post-socialist history. And then after that, I mean, I completed that project in 2011. And then after I kind of did a disciplinary shift that was pretty significant, and I switched from anthropology to Chinese studies. And in that process, I started to read a lot more deeply into Chinese film, literature, visual culture studies, and started to think about dance more in the context of cultural history in modern China. And from that perspective, I actually decided to completely sort of start over and rewrite the book and redo the research from a cultural history perspective. And so the actual book is a product of that that second phase of research that I did after completing the dissertation. And that's why it's actually much more of a dance history than an ethnography per se, although the last chapter does draw on my ethnographic research.
Well, that's very cool, sort of seeing the way that the changes in disciplines have helped to sort of shape the development of the book. And it does seem to really go through, I think in the introduction you say it's a chronological, it goes chronologically from sort of the 1940s into the present. So that's really interesting to sort of see how that came to be. Since we're sort of moving into the book, I'm just wondering if we could talk a little bit about the book's form itself, because it's sort of unique, and I don't know if the print copy has this, but for one of the things that immediately stood out to me in the book is the way in which you have embedded video excerpts of dance that readers can watch by scanning a QR code on their phones or on some other device. And I love this feature, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about it and sort of how you were able to make that happen.
Yeah, that's actually something I'm really excited about too, because with dance studies, often we do get still images, but what we really need is to see the dance in movement, because that's really what, as dance scholars, we're interested in. And so I was very excited when the Luminous platform at the University of California Press was able to provide this seamless embedded video feature. So if people are watching are reading the ebook version, they can actually just click on the image and it will start to play as a video. And so it really is very easy to integrate the video portion into the reading experience. And like you said, for people who are using the actual physical copy of the book, which is available in softcover, they can just scan the QR code or type in the web link and be able to see the video immediately while they're reading. And there's 19 excerpts of dance works that date from 1947 all the way up to 2015.
Oh, that's super cool. And so did you have to go and get permissions for all of those as well, or?
For most of them I did, yeah. So anything after 1968 needs to have a permission. And so I was able to draw on the personal networks that I had from being a long-term ethnographer in the professional dance community in China. Some of them came from like my former teachers and former collaborators on different projects. And then the videos, for the most part, that came from prior to 1968 were already in the public domain, with the exception of the very first two, which are of Dai Ailian performing Chinese dance in New York in 1947. And for those, I was able to get permission from the, I think, daughter or granddaughter of the person who originally created the film.
Oh, that's so incredible. And truly a tremendous resource, that sort of complementing the book. Well, so I guess without further ado, we should sort of get into the book itself. You're talking about in the introduction about this thing called Chinese dance. It's a genre that has three core commitments: kinesthetic nationalism, ethnic and spatial inclusiveness, and dynamic inheritance. And I was wondering, can you unpack these three terms for us a little bit and sort of how they inform what you are calling Chinese dance?
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing I guess I want to clarify is that the concept of Chinese dance is something that exists in the dance communities in China that has existed back to the very early period of this chronology that I'm writing about, back to the 1940s. And so this is a term that is an internal to the community of dancers that I'm writing about. And my approach in this book was to try to understand what the practitioners themselves actually mean by Chinese dance and how their own theorization of this concept has actually produced this dance genre that has a huge role in Chinese dance practice today, not only in China, but also among diasporic communities and Sinophone communities in other parts of the world. So the term itself, Chinese dance, and its constituent subforms, which include Chinese classical dance and Chinese national folk dance, that concept is something that already existed, that part of the purpose of the book was to sort of really unpack and understand what it is from the perspective of the people who practice it and who identify with it. And so the three core commitments are features that I identified as really persistent values that dance practitioners who identify with this practice of Chinese dance have enacted through their choreographic choices, through their pedagogical choices, through the institutional development, and then through their own theorization and writing, basically throughout the whole history of the form. And so the first one, kinesthetic nationalism, it really dates back to the national forms movement of the late 30s and early 40s, 民族形式. And this was a concept that many people associate with Yan'an. It was theorized in the late 30s and early 40s at the very beginning of the Yangge movement in the communist area during the Sino-Japanese War. But also there were intellectuals and artists who participated in that dialogue about 民族形式 or national forms actually across the country. And it was that dialogue and that effort to sort of develop national forms in a whole wide range of artistic spheres, like visual arts, theater, language, music, that dance actually became part of this larger movement to create a national form or a national expressive aesthetic or vocabulary that could be developed within the sphere of dance. And so kinesthetic nationalism for me is the set of ideas that emerged out of that, that set of dialogues and debates and experiments in which practitioners of Chinese dance really identify dance form, or what's sometimes referred to as a movement vocabulary, the movements themselves, the styles of the movements, as what defines this genre from other genres. So what distinguishes Chinese dance from ballet, for example, or from ballroom dance, or from your American modern dance, is actually the vocabulary of movements that the body is performing. And this is really important because a lot of the early theorists of Chinese dance really wanted to make a distinction between who was performing the dance, or what the themes of the dance were. So Dai Ailian, who's one of the early theorists of this concept, says, you know, just because Chinese people are dancing doesn't make it Chinese dance. What makes a Chinese dance is that the movements themselves have some kind of distinctive vocabulary. And she also made the similar argument saying, you know, even if it's a dance that's about a Chinese story, or it's telling some kind of, it's portraying some kind of character that exists within a Chinese historical framework, that too does not make the dance Chinese dance. So for her, it was very explicit that it was the form of the movement that identified it as Chinese dance. And this was something that I saw play out actually again and again when I was doing oral histories, when I was reading the dance criticism, dance bulletins, and other dance publications in which dancers and choreographers were writing about their theorizations of Chinese dance, sort of all the way through from the 1950s, 60s, 80s, 90s, and the present. This is a constant theme that emerges in Chinese dance discourse, is the importance of the movement vocabulary and the dance form as the identifying feature. And I thought this was also extremely important because when we talk about the socialist period, this book is very much about how we should understand the legacy of socialist creativity in the sphere of dance. And there's existing language about sort of the importance of socialist realism, the importance of certain themes, and also many people look to ballet as a really key feature or phenomenon that emerged out of that period. And one of the really important contributions that this book makes and that I found through my research is that experiments in form were actually a huge part of the socialist aesthetic practice. And so the creation of new forms, which is something we often don't necessarily associate with the socialist period, was actually very much a vibrant feature of dance, especially in the 1950s and early 60s, which I see as sort of the early golden age of Chinese dance when it really emerged and crystallized as an art form. And so this whole issue of dance form, of the creation of new expressive vocabularies in dance as sort of the heart of what Chinese dance is about, is something that I was trying to express through the concept of kinesthetic nationalism, because the concept was to create a national form, a movement expression that could somehow be distinctively Chinese. So that's the first of the three. Do you want me to go on and talk about the other two also?
Yes, please.
I can. Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure because I know I just talked for kind of a long time. Okay. So for the second one, ethnic and spatial inclusiveness, this is another feature that kind of goes through the entire 80 years of Chinese dance history that I trace in the book. It's a continuous feature. Even as other things change, this is another thing that has stayed constant through time. And so what this means is that the overall genre of Chinese dance, it includes dozens, even hundreds of sort of sub-vocabularies or sub-forms that are all included under this umbrella of Chinese dance. And within those sub-forms, what you find is that people very closely identify a specific style of movement with either a specific geographical place within China. So many dance styles within Chinese dance are actually named after places. So for example, you have Shandong Jiaozhou Yangge, which is the Yangge form specific to the Jiaozhou region of Shandong province. And then you also have a number of dance forms that are named after specific ethnic groups. So you have Uyghur dance, you have Tibetan dance, you have Dai dance, for example. And within those, there's also specific regional variations. And so this geographic and ethnic mapping of dance styles onto specific communities is something that you see throughout time within the Chinese dance community as something that dancers are constantly taking for granted as something that should be a part of Chinese dance choreography, is that specific vocabularies should reflect specific ethnic and regional identities. And the regional part is actually very important because many people who are familiar with Chinese dance know that it expresses different ethnic identities because they're familiar with sort of seeing different minority dance styles presented on stage. But what many people don't realize is that actually many of the different dance styles that are included in Chinese dance are actually representations of local Han ethnic identities. And so like the example I just gave of Shandong Jiaozhou Yangge is classified as a Han ethnic dance of a particular region. And from the early period of the emergence of this dance form, you can see a really clear structuring of, for example, the conservatory curricula are designed around these quote unquote regions and ethnicities. So at different times, there'll be like the four regions and the five ethnicities. And so this geographic and spatial imaginary is part of a larger ethnic imaginary that goes into the creation of Chinese dance as an expression of China as a nation as a whole. And so another part of that is that throughout history, there's been a large number of practitioners who come from these diverse regions across the country and also different ethnic backgrounds who have contributed to the creation of the dance form. And in this way, this makes Chinese dance, I think, a really great space in which to examine issues of China's changing multi-ethnic identity throughout different historical periods. And then lastly, the concept of dynamic inheritance is also something that I see. It was something that I first encountered as an ethnographer when I was, taking Chinese dance classes every day and sort of immersed in the atmosphere of dialogue by Chinese dance practitioners and scholars, was a really clear sense that although Chinese dance is classified as a folk form or a classical form, it's actually not, the practitioners themselves are not envisioning what they're doing as a static preservation of existing forms. So in this way, the sort of ideologies or theorizations of Chinese dance don't actually fit into a lot of the existing conceptions that we have in the West about what folk dance is or what classical dance is as something that's always looking back to the past and sort of meant to be preserving something in its exact form into the current or future moments. And instead, what I found was that people had a very self-reflexive concept of their own role in reimagining and recreating tradition constantly through each generation. And so the idea of dynamic inheritance is actually meant to theorize what I find to be one of the basic assumptions and values within this Chinese dance practitioner community, which is that each generation actually has the responsibility to reimagine and recreate traditional forms, to make them current and to make them appeal to a new contemporary community of audience members and dancers. And so this dynamism of constant change is actually, and innovation is actually built into the notion of inheritance within this practitioner community.
That's really interesting to me. I think the idea of kinesthetic nationalism really sort of, I can really see that, and definitely the spatial sort of inclusion element is certainly. I'm curious about the dynamic inheritance, because I think a lot of Western scholars, particularly ethnographers, would agree that traditions are by nature dynamic. But is the Chinese take on this sort of a dynamic inheritance somehow unique or somehow different from the way Western scholars might take it?
So it's hard to say because, of course, you know, Western theorization is very diverse and it's also changing and it also depends on the different fields. But if I just take sort of the dance world as its own example, I would say that there's still a gap between scholars who look at concert dance or art dance, sort of dance that's for the stage, that's understood to be the product of artistic creation on the one hand, and then scholars who look at ethnic dance or folk dance or national dance, which is often assumed to be much more embedded in local shared knowledge and shared creative practices rather than sort of individual artistic creativity. And one of the things that I think is important about this concept of dynamic inheritance that exists within the Chinese dance sphere is that it very clearly bridges those two worlds. And it shows that the dichotomy between art dance and ethnic dance, for example, is actually a false dichotomy. And we see this play out, actually. There's been a great deal of dance research on the modern construction of Indian classical dance. So in the South Asian context, there's been a lot of really excellent scholarship that has shown us the ways in which the emergence of classical Indian dance was very much a specific historical example that happened in the context of late colonial, anti-colonial movements. There were specific artists who were involved in reimagining and recreating these forms. And then also there are a lot of class dimensions involved in the hierarchy of practitioners. And I see something similar happening with Chinese dance, where you actually see individual artists playing a very large role in the conceptualization and adaptation of existing dance practices for the concert stage. And even though those are conceptualized as classical or folk, They're actually products of artistic innovation in a similar way to other types of concert dance practices that we might look at as dance scholars. And so for me, I think the Chinese theorization can actually contribute to our ways of thinking about different dance practices in many parts of the world, not just in China. I think it can be actually elevated to a kind of theoretical lens that we can use to break down these dichotomies that exist in our way of thinking about different dance practices.
That's very neat. And I guess sort of once we start talking about the individual dancers and the individual sort of performers who are making these changes, one of the things that also struck me, particularly in the introduction in chapter one, was how international many of these earlier creators of Chinese dance were. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of something I think I read recently about ideas on the international art market, sort of where, you know, this international space it's about the art. But it's different with Chinese dance, where you have these people who have been abroad or come from abroad and come back to China. And I was wondering, is being international sort of a prerequisite for the opportunity or the aesthetic sense to play a role in these creative fine arts at that sort of early moment? Or perhaps was it at that particular point, or am I getting it wrong?
No, I think that's a perfect assessment. I mean, you're right. So one of the things that I discovered in the process of the historical research that I found really exciting is that this early group of founders of Chinese dance did include, like you said, many people who had very intercultural, transnational upbringings. And so Dai Ailian was a third generation diasporic Chinese born and raised in Trinidad, who found her way to China in the 1940s and then became, you know, the leading figure actually of this form at that time. And then you have Kambar Han, who is a Uyghur dancer born in Kashgar, who trained in Uzbekistan and Moscow, really had a full professional career in the former Soviet Union before she moved back to Xinjiang in the early 1940s and also became a leading figure. Then you have Che Sun Hee, who is actually a Korean dancer who trained in Tokyo. She grew up during the Japanese colonial period in Korea, and she became an internationally known dancer and then eventually came to China in the 1940s and contributed to this field. And then you have other figures like Wu Xiaobang, who was born and raised in China, but was exposed to dance and received his dance training in Japan during the 1930s. And so these are just some examples of the people who were part of this early generation. And I think, you know, absolutely, you see a predominance of figures like these who had professional dance careers abroad, or at least trained abroad. And I think part of the reason for that is that the concept of concert dance as an independent artistic sphere, separate from music and theater, was actually something that was relatively new in China in the early 20th century. And of course, China has a long history of dance performance. But throughout time, dance has often been combined with theater or with ritual practices or with music. And especially during the Qing Dynasty, dance was usually part of the operatic sphere. And so in the early 20th century, there really wasn't an indigenous field of concert dance that could produce these really, you know, influential, highly trained figures. And so for that reason, many of the early members of this cohort received their training abroad, and it was abroad that they were exposed to and initiated into this profession of dance. And so because of that, you do see that the early generation is sort of bringing a lot of their training and their inspiration from abroad. And apart from that, I mean, there was definitely a large amount of folk performance that included dance as a huge element. But that wasn't really present in a lot of the urban areas where we see the concert stage emerging as a really important site of entertainment and political culture, especially with like the spoken drama movement. And so it's really in the urban areas that you have a lot of these cosmopolitan or transnational communities, and you have a lot of the documented discourses about the creation of modern concert dance. And so, you know, like you said, like many other artistic forms at the time, a lot of the new developments were happening in the context of these global circulations of people.
It's really neat. It's something I feel like I've seen a lot of my own research as well. And I guess maybe we can sort of jump straight into one of the examples that you profile in chapter one. This is Trinidad-born Dai Ailian, who you've mentioned once or twice already. And how did Dai Ailian come to play such a significant role in Chinese dance? And what were the, and how does her story serve as a sort of a lens through which to understand some of the major developments in China's dance history during the early 20th century?
So the first chapter really does use her biography as a way into this story. And one of the things that I think is really important about her story is that she started her career actually in London as a diasporic Chinese in a colonial context. I mean, she was a subject, a colonial British subject growing up in Trinidad. And I really wanted to highlight the global dance social organization of the dance field at that time outside China. And one of the things I wanted to note was for dancers who were not of European heritage, dancers of color, they faced tremendous challenges that are in some ways parallel to the challenges that dancers might face today who are working in Europe or the United States or other predominantly white societies. And I wanted to really highlight that issue of ethnic and racial stereotyping and prejudice as something that was a driving force in the creation of Chinese dance. So on the one hand, Chinese dance emerged in China as part of China's own, Chinese artists' own struggle to establish their own expressions of modern society, modern experiences. But also this is driven by a broader transnational phenomenon in which you have the hegemonic status of forms like ballet and Western modern dance, which come from Euro-American colonial cosmopolitan centers. And you have a strong sort of sense of desire on the part of artists who are not able to easily assimilate into that dance world, and also who want to bring their own cultural contributions to the concert stage at that time. And so Dai Ailian, when she's living in England, she really faces this dilemma because as a diasporic dancer, she has trouble getting the same types of roles as other dancers that she studied alongside of. And she also gets, she gets cast for Orientalist productions, for productions such as in film that have a very strong anti-Chinese, like yellow peril sentiment, which was common to a lot of transnational representations of China at the time. And so it's in that context that she starts to develop a sense of her own ethnic consciousness and a desire to have her own voice in deciding how Chinese subjects are represented on the concert stage. And that's part of what drives her to actually emigrate to China when she's in her early 20s, even though she can't speak Chinese, she's never been to Asia before. And, you know, I think of her as a very inspiring, very brave figure to take this this journey across the world. In the early 1940s, she arrives in Hong Kong. And then because it's the wartime, she actually is able to participate in a lot of the fundraising events to actually raise consciousness and raise funds to support the Chinese side of the Sino-Japanese War. And so it's within that very particular historical moment that all of these different things converge in terms of her own experience as a dancer, the larger movement to sort of bring overseas Chinese into this national consciousness, which was happening all over, not just in dance, but in many different fields at the time. And so it's a convergence of events. And then she ends up in Chongqing, which at the time was the KMT capital during the war. And she ends up, you know, getting embedded into a lot of the local artistic communities, in part through her husband, Ye Qianyu, who's a famous Chinese painter and cartoonist, he sketched a lot of really now very enduring images actually of dancers, including Dai Ailian's own dance, but also of a number of other dancers at the time. And so it's through her connection to Ye Qianyu, she gets involved in the leftist artistic community in Chongqing. And it's actually there that she develops a whole cohort of students and collaborators. And she conducts her own field work. So this is another way in which she's actually a very inspiring figure. She is not content to sort of remain in the major urban centers. She really feels that in order to find the material that she wants to use to create these new concert dance forms, she needs to go out to many different parts of the country. So she travels to what was at the time part of the Tibetan region, which is now in Western Sichuan. She goes to Kangding and she does ethnographic field work with Tibetan dancers there. She also travels through many other parts of like Guangxi province in Southwest China and encounters different local theater forms like Gwei Opera, for example, and then also different performance practices of different ethnic groups living in Southwest China. And all of that actually inspires her to create the first repertoire of what at the time was known as frontier dance, Bianjiangwu, which she staged in Chongqing along with some local groups of Tibetan and Mongolian and Uyghur students in Chongqing, as well as her own students who had come for the most part from the Eastern Seaboard during the war. And they staged this important event in 1946, which actually now is seen as the important sort of founding moment of Chinese dance, and particularly of Chinese national folk dance and ethnic minority dance in the modern period.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
What an inspiring figure. That's really incredible. Moving swiftly onward to the 1950s, the second chapter entitled Experiments in Form sort of looks into to a point you mentioned in passing earlier about how in sort of the socialist period, there was actually a tremendous amount of innovation. And you start this chapter with this discussion about how there was a need to train a tremendous number of new dancers to accommodate demands for more performers who can dance in governmental song and dance troupes. And I was wondering if you could take this take a second to sort of introduce us to how in the 1950s this Chinese dance form, how this innovation happened, and what were some of the major trends of the period?
Yeah. So one of the things that I really highlight in this chapter is the way in which there was not a set concept of sort of a top-down idea of what Chinese dance should be or what socialist dance should be. And so I start the chapter with these really controversial works that emerged in 1950, where you had different dance collaborations happening, one in Guangzhou that I look at and one in Beijing, where they start to stage these full-length productions of narrative dance performances using a very wide range of different dance styles. And then you have critics responding to these experiments and sort of debating the merits of different choices that dancers make. So there's a piece called Peace Dove that really uses a lot of ballet movement vocabulary and modern dance vocabulary and uses a lot of abstract modernist stage designs. And that piece, even though it's expressing actually a really important political theme of the time, which was the international peace movement, which politically really did fit into the agenda of the period because aesthetically it relied so much on classical European forms and also modernist European forms. The piece was heavily criticized. And then by contrast, you have this other production that was actually staged in Guangzhou that used a mix of Chinese operatic elements, modern dance elements. It used a lot of field research methods to sort of understand the recent history that the piece was actually portraying. It was about a military victory that happened in Hainan Island during the Civil War. And so I really wanted to highlight the ways in which the critics and the dancers themselves were unsure of what socialist dance should look like. And it was a moment of debate and artistic experimentation, sort of trying to figure out what the path forward should be like. And that was important for me because when I was reading, the early dance journals and publications at this time, there's a really clear sense of a legitimate, genuine debate happening rather than sort of what we often think of as a top-down, declaration of this is what dance should be, and then everybody follows it. In a way, there was actually much more diversity in terms of the opinions of different dancers about what they wanted to create, what they thought the future should look like. And I wanted to give a sense of that sense of uncertainty about the future that was really present in the early 1950s. So what I show is that through this debate that happened over these two dance works in 1950, you then had dancers sort of unsatisfied with both examples and looking for other options. And so then it just happens that at that time, there's a tour of ethnic minority performance groups that happens that really inspires a lot of people, again, to see ethnic minority forms as an important contributor to the larger process of creating a national socialist dance form. But at the same time, because the Korean War is happening, Che Sung-hee, this Korean dancer, gets invited to Beijing and actually trains this really important generation of early choreographers and dancers at the Central Academy of Drama. And so she contributes her own theorization and actual artistic experiments using the bodily forms of movement that exist in Chinese operatic theater. And so she contributes a lot to sort of this idea of, actually maybe movements that come from Xiqu performance, from Kunqu or from Jingju, from Chinese operatic forms can actually be a really important resource for Chinese dance creators. And so through these different experiments that happen in like 1950, 51, and 52, you do start to get a consensus by 1953 that's pretty clear, that ends up being the model that's used to create the Chinese, the first major Chinese dance conservatory, which is the Beijing Dance School. Now it's known as the Beijing Dance Academy, but that's created in 1954. And when the school is created, it creates the first national curriculum for Chinese dance training, which I argue is actually very, very important if we think about the genesis of a new art form, because in order to have a dance vocabulary, you need to have bodies that are trained in that vocabulary who can perform that vocabulary of movement. And so the dance curriculum that's established at the Beijing Dance School is extremely important for crystallizing this new genre as a coherent form. And what I show is that early curriculum really centered movement vocabularies that were in some way adapted from indigenous movement practices. So on the one hand, you have Chinese classical dance, which is at the time really taking inspiration from Chinese operatic movement. And it's created in collaboration also with opera practitioners. And then on the other hand, you have this curriculum of the quote unquote, you know, four regions and five ethnicities, where you have dance styles that are based on different geographic regions of Han performance and then different ethnic minority groups. And those are also created in collaboration with different representatives from different parts of the country. And the Uyghur dancer I mentioned earlier, Kambar Han, is invited in 1953 to Beijing to actually train the first generation of teachers at the school, along with a number of regional experts that come from over the country. And so I end the chapter by looking at the construction of the school curriculum, which then ends up being the model that's actually adapted by other regional dance schools that are established throughout the period.
It's really interesting to sort of see how that, how those early formations continue to resonate much later on, and we'll get to that. But in the middle stage, chapter three, which is about sort of performing a socialist nation, looks at developments of dance during the Great Leap Forward, sort of the late 1950s and early 1960s. What are the key developments of this period, and how do they differ from the period immediately preceding it?
Yeah. So one of the things I really highlight about this period, especially in the late 1950s, is the transnational circulation of Chinese dance. And so Chinese dance is not happening in a vacuum. It's really happening in dialogue with many other national dance movements that are happening in other parts of the world, and especially in the leftist sphere and socialist countries, and also countries that became involved with the non-aligned movement, with the Bandung Conference, and so on. So you have a convergence of, on the one hand, a lot of anti-colonial and post-colonial dance movements that are producing these new representations of indigenous cultures around the world and national cultures around the world through dance. But then you also have in the socialist sphere, especially in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, but also in North Korea and Vietnam, you have the construction of these socialist folk dance forms, especially in ethnic dance forms. And all of these dance styles are actually being staged in these international events. And so one of the events that I look at is the World Festivals of Youth and Students, where Chinese dancers consistently performed and won awards all the way from 1949 up until 1962. And so I look at Chinese dance on the world stage as one of the spaces in which Chinese dancers were getting a lot of inspiration and ideas about how to move forward with their art form in dialogue with these other experiments that were happening around the world. So that's one of the important developments of this period. And another important development is the emergence of what becomes known as the Minzuju, or Chinese dance drama, or national dance drama, which is meant to be a full-length narrative dance production. And one of the things that's important about it is that it allows for complex narratives and stories and characters to actually emerge on stage through dance. And this is really important because a lot of the earlier dance choreography was, you know, shorter, especially in the Chinese dance choreography, it was shorter, non-narrative often choreographies that were meant to sort of represent or stage a specific regional identity or ethnic identity or sort of new class consciousness or new, you know, sometimes gender image, but it wasn't necessarily carrying out a complex storyline. And the national dance dramas that, that came about, particularly in the late 1950s, they were able to take dance to a much higher level in terms of the types of complex ideological and political themes that they could address through the narrative devices that were developed for the stage for dance performance. And so in the late 1950s, you get the emergence of these, a series of national dance dramas that take up different themes. And so I look at three that were actually recorded in film form. And so we have full documentation of these stage choreographies that were adapted for film. And so I look at how these choreographies dealt with issues such as marriage choice, which is a really important issue for the communist state, especially early on in the 1950s, sort of promoting these new ways of promoting new gender relations and new family structures around the idea of gender equality and the role of youth in choosing their own marriage partners. And so there are dances that are sort of about that theme. There are dances that deal with the understanding of Chinese history in relation to the colonialization of Asia and sort of where China fits into this anti-colonial rebellion that starts. So one of the dances actually looks at a local peasant revolt that happened in Shanghai during the Taiping Rebellion as a way of rethinking the long history of peasant uprising in China as something that is a class issue, but as also an issue of fighting against the colonial exploitation of China by European and US forces in the 19th century. And so, and then the last piece that I look at that's an example of this is a piece that is about the Civil War, but focuses on an ethnic minority community in Yunnan and sort of thinks about the interconnected relationships of class exploitation and ethnic exploitation in the period prior to the establishment of the People's Republic of China. And so I think these pieces are actually examples of the way in which dance can help us to understand the ideological and political commitments of different moments in the historical trajectory of the People's Republic of China. And specifically during the Great Leap Forward, you see a lot of experimentation with new types of gendered figures. So I look at some of the lead characters of these dance dramas who are often women. And they combine in really interesting ways elements of more traditional femininity with the socialist era ways of thinking about women's role in society. And so we can look at the gradual progression of these different concepts that happen on the stage through dance choreography at this time.
Very neat stuff. Just all the way through, there are so many different points that could be sort of unraveled a bit more. But I want to jump over to the next chapter, which moves us forward from the Great Leap Forward into the Cultural Revolution. And in it, it's called A Revolt from Within, and you're looking at revolutionary ballet during the Cultural Revolution. And you describe sort of ballet as sort of an other against which the, prior to the Cultural Revolution as being sort of the other against which the Chinese dance self could be defined. So what happens in the Cultural Revolution and how does it help us better understand Chinese dance?
Yeah, thanks. So this is actually one of the hardest chapters to write in the whole book because in many ways I found it to be very paradoxical that ballet ended up becoming this really important symbol of socialist culture during the Cultural Revolution, because it didn't fit with everything that had been happening prior to the Cultural Revolution. So if you look at the debates that were going on, the ways that people were theorizing, exactly as you said, people were consistently theorizing ballet as being inconsistent with Chinese socialist values. And so whether it was because prior to the establishment of the PRC, ballet was mainly introduced to China by so-called white Russians who had fled the Soviet Union because they didn't support the communist regime. They were the ones actually teaching ballet in urban centers. And in the 1940s, ballet was associated with urban bourgeois culture. And so from that sense, it was seen as antithetical to socialist values. And then also because it was Western, it was seen as incapable of expressing a distinctive Chinese aesthetic sensibility and cultural heritage on stage. And so there are many reasons for, that people saw ballet as really not the right fit for what they wanted to, see on stage to express the new Chinese socialist culture. However, by the mid-1960s, there's so much debate going on and so much, new sort of experiments continuing to take place. And one of the things that happens is that you start to see countries from the non-Western world actually using ballet as an expression of their own modern national identity. So there's a really pivotal event that happens in 1958 where a Japanese ballet ensemble comes to China and performs The Wayward Girl. And around that same time, just a couple years later, the Cuban ballet comes. And so there's this awareness that ballet is actually being appropriated actually by third world countries, or in the case of Japan, other East Asian countries, to express very different sensibilities. And Chinese dancers start to be inspired by this concept that ballet can actually be appropriated and transformed into a local expressive form. So that's one thing that happens. And the other thing that happens is that, of course, you have constant friction and factions within the dance world. And so in some ways, the Chinese dance world was very much competing with the ballet subfield, even though the ballet practitioners actually represented a much smaller number in the broader sort of overall body of dancers as a whole. But because they were consistently given a space to sort of experiment with ballet, they continued to advocate for their own interests. And so I think what happened when the Cultural Revolution broke out is that you had these competing factions, and in some ways Chinese dance had become so established as the official symbol of the socialist country that it actually became associated in the hierarchy, it became associated with the established institutionalized culture that needed to be overturned when the Cultural Revolution happened. And so the ballet community was paradoxically the smaller, the less visible part of the dance world. And they were able to take advantage of this, call for revolution to overturn the existing hierarchy and actually displace the status that Chinese dance had had through the previous 17 years. And so there you get this 10-year period in the Cultural Revolution where ballet actually takes the lead and becomes the hegemonic form at the expense of Chinese dance. And so at that time, one of the things I talk about is how pretty much all of the leading figures of Chinese dance were attacked and criticized. And then you also have the first generation of Chinese dancers trained in the PRC who are also attacked and criticized. And Chinese dance as a whole is banned during the Cultural Revolution for the most part, except for what you see emerging within the context of revolutionary ballets. And so again, this is sort of also speaking back to this theme that Chinese communist culture, socialist culture is not homogeneous. It's not monolithic. There's different different groups within that world that have different competing values, and they're constantly in flux, and they're constantly challenging one another to establish new ideas. And so it's showing, in a way, the continuous dynamism of this field. Even in this context, it becomes actually very violent.
I'm still just in my mind trying to wrap my head around sort of ballet becoming sort of bourgeois, or not bourgeois, but proletarian. I don't think I have enough time to deal with the cognitive dissonance. So instead, let's jump over to chapter 5, where you're looking at the post-Mao period. And it's called The Return of Chinese Dance. And you're looking at the development of new forms in the early post-Mao period. And I wonder if you could discuss a bit about some of the major trends of this sort of return of Chinese dance. and maybe also compare it with some other cultural trends that were developing at that time, sort of like scar literature, root-seeking literature, etc. Are these trends in conversation? Are they similar but different, or what have you?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really great question. So in this chapter, I look at how what happens in the wake of the Cultural Revolution, basically. And one of the things that actually is happening across all these different artistic fields is criticism of the Cultural Revolution in different ways. So like scar literature is not something I talk about in the book, but it's definitely part of this larger context where people are voicing a really strong rejection of the Cultural Revolution in different ways, whether it's through their own life experiences that they're narrating in a very critical fashion, or sort of rejecting the aesthetic practices that were promoted during the Cultural Revolution. And this is happening in dance too. So similarly, in the late 1970s, you get articles critiquing the Gang of Four, critiquing Jiang Qing, and really making a clear statement that the Cultural Revolution was a deviation from correct revolutionary practice in dance. And what this produces, because the Cultural Revolution had really focused on ballet and had suppressed Chinese dance, ironically, this actually creates a space in which Chinese dancers are able to bring back what had been the iconic socialist dance form of the pre-Cultural Revolution period, which was all these Chinese dance choreographies that had been created in the 50s and early 60s. And so you get the return of the practitioners themselves. So they're coming back from, you know, the labor camps, or in some cases from house arrest, or, you know, from various ways in which they had been kept out of the professional dance world. They come back and they reassume their positions. And so the people come back. I really trace the way in which the institutions actually of the early socialist period are reconstructed. They had been in many cases reorganized or demolished during the Cultural Revolution period, but then they were actually recreated on the exact institutional forms, similar names to what they had in the pre-Cultural Revolution period. And so so in the dance field, you get a reemergence of Maoist dance forms that were prevalent prior to the Cultural Revolution. And so this is something that I think gives us a different way of understanding this period. It's not just post-Mao. It's also a re-Maoification of certain aspects of socialist culture that had been suppressed during the Cultural Revolution. And so that's what happened in dance. And so I look at two dance forms that really gained a lot of visibility during this period. So one is the Dai Peacock Dance. And that especially becomes popular through the contributions of this one artist, Yang Liping, who actually today continues to be one of the leading voices in Chinese dance choreography. She's like a huge media icon in China, in addition to being a very successful dancer and choreographer. And she got her start really in the late 1970s when she first performed the role of the Peacock Princess in this dance drama from Xishuang Bana. So that's the one example I look at. And the other example I look at is Dunhuang dance, which is a style of Chinese classical dance that's inspired by the Buddhist art that is been preserved in the Dunhuang Mogao Caves in northwest China. And so I show how these are two examples of following the ongoing pattern in Chinese dance, which is to learn from existing material, whether it's historical material like Dunhuang, or whether it's ethnographic material like the Dai Peacock Dance. So dance choreographers are taking inspiration, they're doing field work, they're doing historical research to create new dance movement vocabularies and movement forms and choreographies. And then they're giving their own new innovative ways of staging those in the concert dance setting. And so you see that with these two examples of new productions with Flowers and Rain on the Silk Road, which is the first full-length Dunhuang dance dance drama. And then with Zhao Shutun and Namaluna, which is the Dai Peacock dance story staged as a dance drama. One of the things I emphasize is that both of these were actually continuations of projects that had started in these regions, in Lanzhou on the one hand, in Yunnan on the other hand, during the 1950s. You can actually trace these projects back to the mid-50s. And so they were projects that had begun that were stalled out because of the Cultural Revolution, but then people started working on them again in the late 70s. And so in that sense, I see this period as continuing directly not only the models of creation, but also really specific projects that had begun in the pre-Cultural Revolution period. And they gained ascendance in the post-Cultural Revolution period because they represented something that was like a new innovation for the time, even though they were building on these earlier projects. Yeah, and so I think it's really interesting to trace these particular dance styles that emerge in the 80s that actually continue to be very much a part of the Chinese dance choreographic repertoire today. So you see, you still see Yang Liping's peacock dance is performed a lot, and there's all constantly new variations of it that are coming out. And the same thing with Dunhuang dance. So Dunhuang dance is now a very important constituent element of Chinese dance today that emerged really on the national stage in the immediate post-cultural revolution period as a continuation of the early socialist forms.
That's really fascinating. And what happened to ballet in this early period?
That's a great question. So I actually don't really talk about what happened in ballet in this period because, you know, the focus of my book is really looking at Chinese dance. But there actually is a whole story to tell about what happens with ballet at that time, because there's a whole bunch of new choreographies that are staged that are actually inspired by modern Chinese literature. So there's Lu Xun based ballets that happened in the early 80s. And so ballet has also its own trajectory that happens that, you know, hopefully someone else will write a book about that, because there's a lot to say.
Some PhD student should be taking note right now.
Actually, there are a couple of people writing about
excellent,
it.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that'll be a future podcast, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. And that's really fascinating. So, and then to wrap up the main body of the book, the final chapter brings us from the sort of the early post-Mao period into the 21st century. And in this chapter entitled Inheriting the Socialist Legacy, you use three examples to look at how people have inherited, how performance and choreographers have simultaneously inherited the socialist dance legacy, but also continue to renew and redefine Chinese dance. And I was wondering if you could sort of take us through these three examples and how they sort of help us see that both simultaneous inheritance and redefinition.
Sure. So the first example I look at is Gulmira Mehmet, who is a Uyghur dancer from Xinjiang, who gained national visibility when she won one of the televised Chinese dance competitions in the 2010s, around 2014, 2015 was really when she became a star in the Chinese dance community. And I look at how she's actually the student of Kambar Han. So she directly carries on this genealogical relationship that happens through dance education. So she was trained in the Xinjiang Arts Academy, Arts Institute that Kambar Han originally served as the founding figure of the dance program there. And so she carries on a lot of Kambar Han's stylistic choices in representing Uyghur ethnicity and also Xinjiang, the Xinjiang region in general, through ethnic dance forms. But I talk about how she really adapts these for, you know, this mediated 21st century dance world, specifically the world of televised competition dance. And so she has you know, really fast delivery of the movements. A lot of the choreographic choices are inspired by Bollywood cinema, for example, and other multimedia representations of dance that we are familiar with today. And so you see, on the one hand, the continuation of Kambar Han's legacy, but on the other hand, you see it being adapted by Gulmira herself for a totally new contemporary viewing audience. So that's the first example. The second example I talk about is the curriculum at the Beijing Dance Academy and how it continues to be modeled on this idea of conducting research at the same time that that new innovations are made in the pedagogical context. And then I also look at new dance dramas that continue in the national dance drama form that continue to be very closely linked to ideological and political themes in contemporary China today. So I look at dance dramas that are actually promoting the One Belt, One Road initiative. And so we can see the way in which dance drama is still being used as a way to educate and propagate average viewers about state initiatives and political movements that are happening, you know, currently that are we're familiar with the new administration in China today. And then lastly, I look at some choreographers who are working within the Chinese dance genre who are actually pushing the self-reflexive aspects of Chinese dance and the formal experimentation in Chinese dance. And so I look at Zhang Yunfeng, who's a Beijing-based choreographer who really deals with questions of historical memory and of staging the encounter between contemporary individuals and their own historical past in different ways through his choreography. And so I see him as someone who's sort of a visionary in taking us into new ways of staging Chinese classical dance themes, but in a way that are really relevant to contemporary audiences, and also are adapting aesthetic dimensions of what we might see as more like avant-garde, experimental, contemporary dance choreography today.
Fascinating stuff. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time today. Before I let you go, though, I was wondering if you could give us one answer one more question, and that's specifically, what are you working on now?
Yeah, so thanks for asking about that. So I am currently working on a new project that continues to look at dance in the Asian context, but I'm really interested in the representation of inter-Asian imaginaries through dance during the early 20th century. So I'm looking at the 1930s to the 1960s. And some of the people were people I had, you know, discovered in the process of writing the first book. So like Dai Alian and then Cha Seung-hee, the Korean dancer. But then some of the people are dancers that, you know, I really didn't get a chance to write about very much in this book, like Mikiko Matsuyama, who's the Japanese ballerina who first performed the role of the white-haired girl in China in 1958. So those are some of the examples of the people I'll be looking at in this new project. And what I'm really interested in is how different concepts of Asian, inter-Asian, transnational consciousness, specifically ideas of the East, emerged from the perspective of Chinese and other Asian choreographers themselves, rather than being represented by, you know, Euro-American choreographers. So in a way, it's a challenge to the history of Orientalist dance to look at how people imagine the East, who identified with the East as their own ethnic identity.
Well, that sounds really fascinating. I can't wait to see to read more as it comes out. Well, the book is Revolutionary Bodies, Chinese Dance and the Socialist Legacy. Thanks very much, Emily, for all your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great talking with you.